So you've just figured out how to survive in college, and now it's time to take on the business world. That presents a whole new bucket of issues.
Do I have to talk to my manager who's in the next toilet stall?
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about navigating the do's and don'ts of workplace culture for someone just getting started. We'll also hear from a history major who decided to travel before jumping into business and spend an academic minute with language and nationalism. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. After years of college life, most students know their way around a campus and how to navigate the everyday customs and subtle messages. So how does that translate into the business world? For a lot of graduates, not so much. That's where Peter Yawitz comes in. He tries to help those newly minted degree holders fit in with his new book, Flip-Flops and Microwaved Fish, Navigating the Do's and Don'ts of Workplace Culture. Yawitz is the founder of Clear Communications and coaches executives and other professionals on how to identify and communicate messages clearly to critical audiences. He also has a website called Advice from Someone Else's Dad, where he gives advice to young professionals on how to manage life at work. I asked him about the idea for the book.
Well, I've been a management communication consultant for about 30 years, and one of my favorite gigs over that time is to run effective communication seminars for new young global hires, most of whom are right out of college. And during the seminars, I usually open it up for questions, and over time I found that these young people are eager to know how to handle themselves in all sorts of situations that they're anticipating. So I developed this persona of what I call someone else's dad, which eventually became a website with lots of advice, some fun and informative video scenarios, and also a Dear Dad column where people can ask me questions. And that just became fodder for this book. And the title was really the publisher's idea. They looked at some things that I've been talking about, and they thought these are the ones that are going to resonate most with the target audience, flip-flops and microwave fish.
You could really boil this whole thing down to how to communicate in business, can't you?
Well, the subtitle is How to Navigate the Do's and Don'ts of Workplace Culture. But yeah, sure, how to communicate in business. And it's the feedback that I've gotten has been from the young people, where the target audience, but also from people, maybe not as old as us, Bob, but certainly middle ground, where people have always said, gosh, if I had only had this when I started my job. Because I think of the mistakes that I've made or that we've all made over time. So my job here is to give people just a straightforward and hopefully amusing way of looking at the workplace and know what to do and what not to do.
A lot of the things you talk about are, you know, common sense business ideas, but there are some things that people should have learned in school, like you have a whole thing on writing skills.
Yeah, you know, I have always been one of these people who loved grammar, which is probably why I didn't have a lot of friends. But I hold that really dear to my core of who I am. You know, the three rules I abide by are the laws of the land, the golden rule, be nice to other people, and make sure you have good grammar. And it bothers me, and I know there are other people like me out there, when they'll read an email and see that something, that there's misuse of words or bad punctuation, and maybe being a little bit oversensitive to it, will judge people a little bit that way. So my view is, here's some basic ideas on how to write. The thing about the English language is that there are lots of ways to say the same thing, and maybe the simplest way is best. Don't try to overcomplicate things. A sentence is just basically a noun and a verb and some other stuff. So keep it simple and just try to impart information.
You have pages of cliches and what you really should be saying there. You have one that is my one of my favorite pet peeves is, it is what it is.
It is what it is.
You want to throw something at someone when they say that.
Yeah, it's just one of these things that's come up in the past couple of years, I think, right? Well, that's how do you end a conversation? Well, you know, that's the way the ball bounces. It is what it is. And then you just kind of stop the conversation there with, yeah, I guess you're right. You can't deny that things are not the way they are. But people use it as a most profound statement. So I'm not necessarily anti-cliche, but I wonder why people say it. And really, people say these phrases because other people say it and they want to fit in well. Some of my least favorite ones are, go after the low-hanging fruit. Just because, everybody says that. And the funny thing about going after low-hanging fruit, I was once talking to someone who grew up on a farm who said, you know, honestly, you don't want to go after the low-hanging fruit because that's all the crummy stuff the animals chew on.
Exactly, yes. Has there always been this kind of communications gap between the generations?
I think there has been. I mean, you know, I'm a baby boomer. I think you are too, right, Bob?
Absolutely.
And when we started at work, there were people who probably looked at us and said, look at those money-grubbing go-getters. And, you know, you said, no, that's not me. My friends are that way, but not me. So I think there's always been a difference in generations, and I think that, and there always will be. So what my recommendation to managers is you have to adapt. A lot of people today say, well, millennials are all, and then fill in the blank. And just the way we said, well, that's just not me, I say the same thing about millennials. They're not all the same. Some people might be more of something than others. But I think it's really up to us workers together to adapt. And one way, the big change now is that, and again, I can't speak for all millennials, but things have changed in terms of social media. And people can see and broadcast what they do and what they like and how they live. And there's a little bit among some people of this fear of missing out and, oh, wow, you have such a great life. I wonder if I could have that kind of life at work. And I think that just can lead to disappointment. And I'm not saying social media is horrible, but I think we have to realize together that if this is out there, all right, understand where people are coming from.
Do you spend more time teaching workers to communicate with managers or the other way around?
Well, it's a combination. A lot of it is, I'd say the questions that I get are really in three areas. One would be on personal growth, let's say how to ask for a raise, how do I get a promotion, how do I get a mentor, to personal workplace issues, which would be, I worry that I don't fit in, I hate company events, do I have to talk to my manager who's in the next toilet stall? And, well, actually, that's in the third one. There's a personal workplace issue is more like how do I deal with small talk? And then the third one is dealing with others, like I have a nasty boss or a smelly coworker, or again, that famous one about talking to a manager in an adjacent toilet stall. So I would say things are really in those three categories.
I don't know if this affects the way you do your work at all, but we now have elected a businessman to office who doesn't follow any of these rules. Does that make your job more difficult?
Well, without getting into political stuff, I will say that one thing that I find is missing in the world is a level of grace. And I do mention that in my book. You know, we all are trying to get along at work. We should share a common goal. And if people aren't playing by the rules, that honestly, that's just not fair. And I think, I don't know whether it comes directly from the top of how the country is run, but it certainly, let's just say it bothers me that there's lack of grace. And that lack of grace has become cultural in some sectors.
That was very good. One of your small talk rules was avoid politics. That's nice.
Yes.
Following your own rules.
Well, this is NPR, so I know a little bit about my audience.
Well, actually, know your audience is one of your basic rules, too, isn't it?
I think that is. When people say to me, in a nutshell, what is the most important thing I should know about communication, it really is know your audience. And whether you think about it, you're doing it every day. I'm talking to you, and your audience might be different from how I would say something to my own children or to a client or to a man on the street or the garbage man. We adapt our messages all the time with the amount of detail and the level of language that we use. So we're doing it naturally, and I think it's important for people to use that skill to think about what you want at work, how you have to talk to anybody, writing or speaking, and to speak at the right level. And another thing that people forget about is timing, which is a part of understanding an audience. How much time now do people have to spend listening to you or reading what you've written? And that's something that a lot of young people really haven't mastered because they are coming from college where they have to write a long paper where they get extra credit for extra work, or they're texting each other with very quick messages. So they have to learn how to balance what is right in the workplace. So yeah, understanding your audience really is the most important thing that you can master as a communicator.
You have stood in front of classrooms before. If you were putting together a course, could you put together a college course to teach people these skills to go out into the world?
I could, and I have stayed away from that just because I don't want to be a college professor doing a semester-long class, but I know people who do. I would say that the only problem teaching a full semester class to college students is that it becomes too theoretical. The most successful communication courses are ones that are taught maybe in executive MBA programs because people are working and also communicating at the same time. So it's really important to have a context for communication. So as much as I think it's great to take a course in undergrad in communication, if it's not real and too theoretical, it's a little bit harder for people to grasp.
I have to ask, I had fun reading it. How much fun did you have writing this book?
I had a ton of fun writing it. I knew when I was writing it. Well, thank you, first of all. I knew that, you know, my style is a little bit on the cynical, sarcastic, and funny side. But then again, and that's how I conduct my seminars. I want people to have a good time. And in fact, some of the young kids say to me, like, have you ever thought of a career in stand-up? And I'm very flattered by that. But I also want them to enjoy themselves, but also to get some great information. So thanks for the feedback. I think it's pretty funny, too.
So moving ahead, do you see, is there hope? Will we learn to communicate?
I don't know. If they read my book, the answer is absolutely so.
Again, the name of Peter Jawitz's new book is Flip-Flops and Microwaved Fish, Navigating the Do's and Don'ts of Workplace Culture. Still to come, some people choose travel over business when they leave school. We'll hear from one next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Matt Plummer graduated college in 2013 with a bachelor's in history and the looming question of what's next? He was 23 and had just started landscaping on Martha's Vineyard when the realization came to him he had never traveled outside of the U.S. Plummer decided it was time to go. Giving himself 1 month to travel in his chosen destination of Peru, he booked a flight to Lima. That was it. He says it was the perfect time to just pick up and immerse himself in the Peruvian culture. He spoke about his journey with The Best of Our Knowledge's Elizabeth Hill.
I didn't necessarily know what I was going to do. I didn't know if I was going to jump back into school. I didn't know if I was going to go for something else. So I was like, well, I need to get away. Kaylee, who was my ex, worked in Martha's Vineyard at the year before. So it was like this connection of knowing we could go somewhere and just like be away. But the luxury of that place, it's very expensive, but you make a lot of money. That was like the thing that allowed us to do this, you know?
Yeah. So I'm looking across the table at your beautiful book. I'm assuming you guys created an itinerary or did you just show up in the country?
You know, it was a mix of both. It was a really interesting, like, we wanted to have a plan, but then we were also pretty intent on the idea that we want to go with the flow and just see what happens. But we booked this trip originally when we were in Martha's Vineyard with just a ticket there. No ticket.
Nice.
So we didn't have that game plan set. And then it was like a week before we left that we were just like, what if we something happens, or what if we just like get in the situation where we can't book a flight, or, you know, we kind of thought about it. So then we gave ourselves a month and decided we can always alter things if we want. But yeah, we went with the idea of having a certain game plan, but all of our itinerary and everything really developed when we got there.
Was that terrifying?
Yeah.
Because
yeah, we were terrified.
Terrifying.
We were naive and I think we were just like, yeah, we're like, this is the first big trip for us out of the country, going for it. But I remember flying into Lima and we were scared, definitely right away. We flew in at like 11 at night, maybe even later. And we had a driver who drove us right to the hostel, but like we drove through a very poor area in Lima. And I think you have to shake off those, like, I don't know what we were expecting. If it was just like, oh, Lima's like a Miami or something like that. And it's like, yeah, well, even parts of Miami aren't the best, you know?
Yeah.
I think you just have to take in, like, the world isn't all this beautiful, you know, and luxurious. And I don't know what we were expecting, but the drive-in, I remember looking at Kaylee and just, and she was scared and I was scared too, but I just was like, you know, we're okay. This is what it is. Like, and initially we were scared. And then I remember waking up the next morning and walking around and being like, we're fine, you know? Like,
yeah.
We were in a very nice part of Lima. I can't exactly remember. There's a few different districts in Lima, and I was looking for it in this book I have here, but I can't remember exactly where it is, but it's a very touristy, very hostels everywhere, really a huge, eclectic, diverse population, both immigrant and indigenous. So it was a very cool vibe, but it did take us like a day to be like, okay, we feel comfortable, we feel okay. So, and I think that goes with any trip, you know, you're gonna feel that fear of the unknown and all that.
Did you guys speak Spanish at all?
I did a little bit.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm by no means fluent, but I took middle school and high school and 2 years of college. So I had, you know, 6 or 7 years of Spanish speaking. Again, by no means fluent, but we made it around and we did well. You know, I could converse, I could talk to people, and it certainly got better as the month progressed. But down there too, English is it's there. You can, a lot of people speak English. A lot of Europeans who are traveling with you speak English. If you're German, you have to learn English. You know, if you're going to be in business industry, essentially,
right,
in Europe, you have to learn English. So we got around fine. And I think you learn with traveling. Conversing comes in so many forms. You can really talk to someone. And if you have to, you know, if you're in that situation and you just have to both understand each other, you somehow find a way, you know. And I think that happened a lot down there, in both regular situations and awkward situations. Kaylee was by no means fluent and couldn't really talk. She could say, you know, quanto cuesta, like how much does it cost, and a few things, but like nothing. I led the way in that. I'll give myself the pat on the back for that, because she certainly led the way with help setting up everything and planning things out. So, but I'll take the language credit.
You're an adventurer, obviously. Did you go down for hiking? Did you go down for the music?
Yeah, it was definitely a trekking adventure. Not to say I wasn't looking for leisure, but Peru is interesting because it is, it's very mountainous. Obviously, the Andes are down there. The main goal, Machu Picchu, was like the thing, you know, we were, that was the focus of the trip. We went in with the mindset of, yeah, like kind of roughing it out, trekking, camping if we could, and essentially moving around as much as possible. I mean, we only went to the beaches in Lima, which there's only a few. The area of the country that's mostly beach and tropical and kind of that vibe is in the northern part of the country, which we didn't actually go to.
Okay.
Trujillo, if my memory serves me right, is a very beachy, resorty type area. And we had some friends who we met traveling who would tell us to go up there. And that's like, if you guys are looking to go to a beach and just hang out for a few days, go up there. But no, it was dominated by trekking and walking and hiking. And that was, you know, both then at that point in my life and now, that's kind of my like release, you know. I love it, and it's my favorite form of exercise.
Yeah.
Definitely. It's a huge part of me.
Did you guys go south?
What we did is we flew into Lima, and we knew that we wanted to make it from Lima to Cusco. That was like the main goal.
Right.
And when we got down there is when we actually found out about a really awesome service called Peru Hop. It was a bus created by two Irish guys, and they essentially started a bus service for tourists that brings people all across the country, more specifically from Lima to Cusco. And what you do is you stop in certain places along the way. Our trajectory was from Lima, going south, hitting notable places along the coast, and then heading east to Cusco from there. The most south we went, I believe, was in Pisco, which I believe is named after the famous drink. Pisco is like a very fruity type of alcohol. I don't know exactly what it is. It's almost like a wine, but it's delicious, you know. I think that's the southernmost point we went along the coast, and then we started to go in from there to Cusco. So we didn't go any further south than that. But right off the coast of Pisco was the Ballistas Islands, which are like almost a mini form of the Galapagos. So many birds, so many sea lions. You're in these little kind of like raft boat things in the tour party. There's like four or five of them. And you go to these islands and there's just rocks and rocks filled with sea lions, all just like sleeping next to each other. The most memorable moment for me was we looked up and one of the biggest sea lions, I certainly haven't seen too many sea lions in my life, but the biggest one I've ever seen was just laying. It was like the king of the whole crew, essentially laying on top of the rock. And he just like did this quick turn and pecked and gave a little kiss to one of a female sea lions. And it was adorable.
That's awesome.
And amazing. I'll always remember that because it was just like, I was just looking at the perfect moment and just like happened to be like, oh my God, like that one always sticks out to me. But it was absolutely beautiful. I think that was probably the southernmost area where we went as far as the coast. And then going into the country is beautiful, a mix of desert, mountains. My favorite place to go is probably, it's called Huacachina. It's surrounding the like Nazca area, which I don't know, it's one of the famous landmarks in Peru is the Nazca Lines.
Okay.
It's these amazingly intricate and beautiful ruins. You can only see them from flight, essentially, if you're in an airplane or in a tower or something. But the famous one is like a monkey drawn into the sand, into the desert. There's dozens of other symbols, but that's like a very notable landmark that we went to. And right around there is this town called Huacachina that is notable for, it has an oasis. So it's literally this beautiful green oasis town surrounded by miles and miles of desert and sand dunes.
Yeah.
And one of the like highlights of our trip was we went dune buggying and sandboarding out
there. Nice.
Yeah. And I got to find that picture because I'm not a snowboarder or a skier, but I guess I should be. I was petrified. Talk about scared. You look down and you see these mountains of sand and you're on these, you know, makeshift surfboards, which are sandboards, and you go down it. And I just remember feeling the rush and feeling like absolutely amazing. And then, you know, you're in these dune buggies, which if, you know, you can take a look, but they're really cool and goofy and scary all at the same time. And I remember the one we were in kept shooting out. The guy was saying it was water, but it looked like it was leaking from the fuel tanks.
Oh, good.
You know, just like all those classic things that go with traveling.
A
like,
real adventure.
Oh, yeah.
Catch fire.
Yeah. So it was that to me was like one of the most notable moments. And we spent two nights there, I believe. And one night, about five or six people, all from various. There was a guy from England. There were two people from Germany. And three people from the States, and then us. And we all climbed to the top of one of the highest sand dunes we could, which was like hiking in the sand is not.
It's awful.
It's literally one of the worst, most intense things you can do. And we hiked to the top of it. I brought, I'm a musician, so I brought my traveling guitar with me, this little Martin backpacker. It's very narrow. You can bring it on an airplane, carry it on
cool.
Very easily. Yeah, so it was very clutch for me, knowing that I couldn't go a month without playing. I carried it up to the top with me, and we all just hung out up there, and more people were up there from the town who we met, and we just like played music and hung out all night. that moment in that town, that was very special. And I do remember getting off the coast and being like, I know there's going to be beautiful places, but what is this like? Is it just barren? Is it just, you know? And this was one of the highlights that really hit me, because it was just, you know, such a cool vibe being in the oasis and then seeing just the desert itself when at night when we were looking out that high up. It was immensely gorgeous.
Well, no worries. Matt Plummer did eventually get a job. He works now as the technical director for the Linda, WAMC Radio's Performing Arts Center. He spoke with Elizabeth Hill for her podcast, Postcards from the Road. You can hear their full conversation and subscribe to that podcast, as well as our podcast, at wamcpodcasts.org. When you're traveling or sitting right at home, the words you choose say a lot about how you view your home country. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
The words we use when we talk about our country can have powerful meanings. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Douglas Dowland, associate professor of English at Ohio Northern University, looks at the role of language in nationalism.
What is America? It's a question that has fascinated politicians and philosophers, readers and writers, since the birth of the Republic. But perhaps more importantly, what words do we use to describe America, and what emotions come with those words? The language of nationalism is the focus of my research. It illuminates new ways of understanding the intense emotions that bind us to our country. And it suggests that while the language of nationalism can separate, it can also create new communities of feeling. It's important to study, for instance, what the description of a part can evoke when an author uses it to represent the entire nation. The novelist John Steinbeck saw America in the debris of an unclean hotel room, insecure handwriting on the hotel stationery, emptied liquor bottles, the torn wrappers of antacid tablets. The journalist Charles Kuralt saw America through the autumn leaves of New England and in the persistence of eccentrics such as the owner of the world's largest ball of twine. You can guess from my descriptions the America they saw, one of waste, another of renewal, one of excess, another of splendor. One is a critical vision of the nation. The other offers hope in doubtful times. There is something irreducible about the nation that drives us to write about it. That is good news in a time such as the present, when it seems we're not quite sure where America is going. And in the nation's irreducibility, its language, and the powerful feelings that come with it, reminds us that through language, through words, we are part of a conversation of the nation we build together.
That was Douglas Dowland of Ohio Northern University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barron. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barron is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org. We'll be right back.